speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Rose.
Hi, I'm Rose, I'm an alcoholic.
Rose.
I'd like to thank Deborah for asking me to speak tonight. I'd like to thank the spiritual timekeeper for keeping me on track, the mic adjuster for making sure everybody can hear me, the name tag people for making sure I have a name tag on. And I'm being completely serious because when I came in to AA, it was jobs like those that kept me here and eventually allowed me to get sober. So my Bible statistics. I have a home group. It's the Sunlight of the Spirit group in Colts Neck, New Jersey. I have a sponsor. Her name is Liz L. I have a sobriety date. It's February 26, 2004. And I'm currently living in steps 10, 11, and 12. It's really cool to be here. I got sober in this group. I came in. I'll talk a little bit about what it was like. And then I'll get to the good stuff. But, when I came into this group, it was not, I was not my best self. But, Bob, my AA angel, reached out his hand. Peggy was here. Jimmy was dancing with God. The people that you see here that are rocks were rocks when I walked in the door, and it's really awesome to see that they're still here. Alcoholism runs rampant through my family. I believe that I just, but I didn't really understand what that meant until I came into AA. I did know a few things. I knew that when I started drinking, I kind of figured out early on that I didn't have a switch. I didn't know how to turn it off. And I was puzzled by the fact that the more I drank, the thirstier I felt. It was a really weird feeling, very strange. I grew up in a loving family. There was alcoholism, but there was also a lot of love. I really started to drink when I was in high school and then in college. And I found myself in a lot of really dangerous situations. Thank God, nothing happened to me. But I went to school with people who ended up dead in East River. So, I don't know what that is. It's, to me, it's a cautionary tale. People like me can't drink safely. When I was in college, and I'll talk about the spirituality aspect of this, because it's something that, I've developed as I've been in AA. Raised Roman Catholic, but never really religious. Didn't have a bit of a problem with it. I remember very specifically one night, I was outside, I was looking at the sky, I saw a shooting star, and for some reason, I said, God, I got you. Don't let anything happen to anyone in my family. That's my wish. And 2 weeks later, my dad was dead. So that was my opportunity to say, God means nothing. It was also my opportunity to get really drunk for a long time. I used that, that injustice. As my excuse for drinking. And this is sort of simple, emblematic of how I behaved when I was drinking. I drank around the clock. I convinced an ex-boyfriend whom I had not treated well or fairly at all to come back to me. I took a hostage. I decided that wasn't working out, so I left the country. And I went and studied abroad in Japan. Because I had messed things up so much, my solution was to just leave. So I left, and I found people who drank like me in another country and proceeded to drink myself silly in another country. I came back, and, surprise, surprise, nothing had changed. The mess was still there. That was a pattern. I then graduated, I moved, I, you know, found myself in relationships that I shouldn't have been in. When things got too messy, I picked up and moved. I had, at this point, I was living in Egypt, and I decided my alcoholic boyfriend just wasn't doing it for me, so I moved back to New York. And my brother, who's also struggling with this disease, had been in an IOP. And I knew enough at that point to know that I had a problem with alcohol. I didn't know anything about AA, but he did. So we started going to meetings. And one of our first meetings was the Tanner's meeting here in this church. And I'm so grateful that when I came into AA, I found a group like this that where you just went right into work. Because if I had my way, I would have skirted around the edges of it, sat in the back, arrived late, left early, and gotten the gift, as Scott already said, step none. Like, I didn't do anything of my own volition. But we arrive at this beginner's meeting, and I'm sure it's the same format. You introduce yourself, and you say what step you're on, who your sponsor is, what your home group is. So like a deer in the headlights, it comes to me, and I don't have a sponsor, I don't have a home group, I'm not working any steps. And all the women just sort of turn around and look at me. And one of those women became my sponsor, and she's my sponsor to this day. Thank God, because she didn't like hammer, you know, AA into me. She just asked for my number and called me and said, hey, how you doing? And at that point, I had been to a few meetings and I saw the steps, which scared the Jesus out of me. And I knew I like these meetings, I'm starting to get this, but I'm not getting a sponsor because that means I'm going to have to do something. And actually, after the second or third phone call, I asked her to be my sponsor. And I don't know what that was. That wasn't me. I think that was my higher power working in my life, continuing to work in my life. And we got right into the work. And I was instructed to get a commitment. And I got commitments in the summer. And thank God for that, because to this day, commitments get me to a meeting. And, you know, I have been doing setup for my home group for a while. Like, the people that do setup, they're the ones that have the doors open for that single-suffering alcoholic who walks in the doors. Thank you, anyone who has a commitment. It's because of you that these meetings exist. So I got commitments, started working the steps, and my life started changing. Like, I had a job. I heard somebody describe it as, you know, I feel like I got off the elevator before it hit the ground floor. I was a functioning adult. I had a job, I had an apartment. I looked okay on the outside, kind of. But my life was so small and ugly on the inside. You know, it's just not normal to know where all the bathrooms are in your office building that women don't go to so that you have a safe place to throw up because you're so drunk and hungover from the night before. Like, my life had become how I didn't want that life at all. But I started to get a life, you know, not A, gave me a life behind beyond my wildest dreams, although I could say that for sure. It kept me here and it put me in a position to live a life that I could never have imagined. So there's so many things I could say. I'd like to reflect on this when I sometimes, as you do in sobriety, you start to feel like, well, is this it? Or, you know, when you're just struggling, I'll leave it at that. So when my dad died, and he was an alcoholic, he struggled with alcoholism all his life, I used that as the excuse to go just get drunk, to enable my drinking. About 3 years ago, my older brother Jim, who I've been saving a seat for many years, he also died of this disease. And I got the phone call at 6:30 in the morning. My mom found him. No mother should have to do that. She called me. She told me what happened. And my first instinct was, what can I do to help? And I got on a plane with my young son, and I went out to Denver, where the family was just falling apart. And I made coffee, and I went to the grocery store, and I did what I was taught to do here, which is to show up and be of service. And that's not my natural state. That's what I learned here. So thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Joey.
Listening to the first speaker. I didn't hear one word. That was bad. All right. Yeah, I think I have a little bit of the self-centered feel they talk about in the book. Alcohol had a profound effect on me before I drank it. My father drank a lot, and it turned him into a nice, welcoming person that I could actually hang around with and be not scared of. Otherwise, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, he would drink a lot. Monday through Thursday was a prison sentence. You know, you didn't know what was gonna happen. My mother traveled a lot for work, so it was just my brother, myself, and my dad. And it was just tough, you know. It was tough. I had to be real tough from the beginning. And you know, so I loved alcohol before I even drank it because of what it did to my family. So when I'm 15, 16, I could kind of get out, get on my own, get my driver's license. It was on. It was on, you know. I drank blackout alcoholically for the first time. There was no in between. It was 100%, you know, 1,000%. Go as fast as you can from the get-go. You know, of course, things start becoming less important. Grades, athletics. I changed friends. I started hanging out with the riffraff, the misfits, instead of the athletes I grew up with. You know, you can find all the idiots real quick if you're one of them. You know. So yeah, man, things start changing. That's what my life was: drinking and partying. Didn't care about anything else. Somehow I made it to college because I did not want to miss out on the partying and drinking. That was my reason for going, not for education, not to better myself. It was to get drunk. And that's what I did. So I got my first DUI when I was in college. First of all, it took me 9 years to graduate, so I don't think that can be beaten. So. But yeah, first DUI in college. Let me tell you, man, I was there for 4 years. I finished online, but that was a tough 4 years, man. It got dark. 2009 was the worst year of my life. You know, at that point, I had probably been under the influence for 4 or 5 straight years, every day. You know, I'm not leaving my apartment. There's every dish in the kitchen is dirty, trash is piled up everywhere. There's 100 natural light, bush light, and all beer cans you can think of. You know, I had cat urine, cat feces everywhere. I mean, it was disgusting. Didn't wash my clothes, you know, didn't open the mail. That's how I was living in 2009. Digging to the couch to get changed, you know, go get a little whiskey, whatever I can get. And I finally dropped out. I couldn't go to class. Moved back in with my parents, who had moved from St. Louis to Florida when I was away at college. Go down there and get my second DUI. Spent 2 months in jail. I hit my bottom in Florida. Thank God for that. I got pulled over on my 27th birthday. Spent the night in jail. Well, yeah, the next day was my birthday. We're getting text messages, phone calls. Happy birthday. Have a good day.
Yes.
It's the worst day of my life. Awful. You know, I'm just laying there hungover. I remember I had to borrow my dad's truck to go out. I had to take my brother's credit card because I had no money. And I went out by myself, you know, that's where I was. But thank God I got pulled over. The next day, I went to my first AA meeting because I was done. I'm sitting there 27 years old, and my life was not the way I wanted it to be at all. And I went to AA meeting. I think I walked there. That's how much willingness I had that day. I walked there an hour and a half or something. I don't remember. Maybe an hour. I stayed for two meetings. I remember the woman speaker had just... She was in prison for a while, and she was drunk driving one night, ran in the back of a car, and the lady was pregnant and killed her baby. And I was like, ooh, that's where I'm at, you know? Now, I went to my meeting, I found hope that day, but I didn't listen to anybody. Joey doesn't, I don't like to listen to people. So I didn't get a sponsor, I didn't go to fellowship, I didn't mark steps. I didn't do anything. I just go to a few meetings a week, not participate. I stayed sober for a few days, a few weeks, relapsed, blah, blah, blah. I made it 7 months was the longest I had. I relapsed. Split my head open in the middle of a relapse, went to the hospital, you know, so I've done the hospital many times, jails, all of it. And I finally moved up here and came to this group. And I decided I should listen. Somewhat, you know, maybe a little more than I had been. So I got a sponsor, went through the steps, got commitments. Commitments saved my life. Because, you know, I don't like letting people down, so I show up, you know. I want to show up and help, so I don't like letting people down. So the commitments were so big for me. They really did save my life. It's just been a long journey for me. You know, I worked through the steps, commitments, all. I listened. And, you know, sobriety's been a long, long, slow journey for me, you know. Defects of character everywhere I still have to work on. I do feel like I've turned a corner. You know, I'm starting to embrace AA, like, fully. You know, I was coming around here for a while, and I never fully embraced it. Got in there, you know. It sucks being on the outside, you know. One foot in, one foot out, it sucks. But, you know, through the pain and suffering of, you know, being sober, you realize you gotta do more. You gotta put the effort in. So that's what I've been doing. I got three commitments this year. I go to, you know, four meetings a week. I work with a sponsor. I call them every day. Well, I'm doing a lot more than I have. But, you know, I can tell it's working. I'm getting more confidence. I feel more connected, you know. Like, isolation is just terrible, and I love it. Like, it's so like, I've been so nervous for this, but I got here today, and I really didn't have time, because I didn't have time to be nervous. I was talking to everybody. And it's not that bad, you know. But in my head, it's the scariest thing. This was so bad. that's my disease, you know. It's not that bad. I make it to a big, disgusting mess, and it's not. You know, it's actually pretty cool. I get to come up here, you know. Considering 8 years ago at this time, I was in jail. I think I went in like early February, so I was in jail 8 years ago. My mom has to come to jail and talk to me through the phone. I give her my green jumpsuit. It's just like, what? You know, what happened, man? So a lot has changed through, you know, getting sober. My brother has found the rooms. He has 3 DUIs, so he beat me. But, you know, I watched him change. I watched my whole family change. It's great. You know, holidays are nothing like they used to be. It's calm, it's loving, caring, it's not a disaster. My parents don't have to worry. So AA saved my life, thanks.
The main speaker tonight is there.
I hope I say something tonight that is useful to someone out there. So my stats, this past January 2nd, I celebrated 16 years of sobriety. So my home group is Rhinelander, and I have a sponsor and some sponsees who are here right now. And I live in 10. And I'm just amazed at how this program, now more than ever, I just feel like it transforms my life every day. And I go to more meetings now, I mean, not more, maybe the same as I did in the first 2 years of my sobriety. And so last week, I gift of sobriety, I was on a silent meditation retreat for 6 days. So with 100 other people up in Massachusetts. And this is going to tie in with sobriety in a second. Obviously, it was to deepen an 11-step practice, and which has been another, you know, obviously due to this program. And so going there, they said you cannot bring any literature, any journals. And they do this whole like phone renunciation ceremony where you give away your phone. And I was like, why? We're already like sitting in this hall meditating all day long and walking around, walking, sitting. And by day 2 to 3, it got really quiet in my head. And it was amazing. And I felt this peace, and all the struggle was gone, and all these, like, and it was all happening in my head. And the teachers would check in with us once in a while to make sure we weren't going crazy or anything. So I said, like, wow, I'm getting kind of scared. It's gotten really quiet. Like, the thoughts aren't even coming anymore. And I said, there's, like, this emptiness. And she said, instead of looking at it like emptiness, why don't you look at it like neutrality? It's just peace. It's when the highs and the lows, they stop, right? Like, I'm not in the memory. I'm not in the fantasy. And I was like, yeah. And this is all I want. This is what sobriety has like led me to want, just this, you know? And I was so present, and I felt so alive. And by the end of the retreat, everything, I was crying. Everything was all in my heart. And I've come to, like, for me, AA, this is a program of the heart. And it's why we can't learn it, you know? We can't read the book. I got back and I had the honor of doing a first step with a sponsee, and we were talking about it. She's super smart, and she, when she was in rehab, read the big book like 2 or 3 times. She knows the literature really well, and then we hit the point when we were going through the reading in the first 43 pages of self-knowledge. You know, like, I'm a New York City therapy kid, and if self-knowledge could have gotten me sober, it would have. It can't, and it's almost like this retreat, like it just got quiet, and then I started feeling things, and then I transformed. And I come to these meetings because I'm listening to you all, and constantly I keep transforming. And then through you guys, my heart opens, and then God, right? And then God comes in. It's all through the heart. It can never be through the mind. So I'm going to go back, because I don't want to just be up here and be wise. I've heard a lot of wise speakers lately, and it never helped me to share their experience, strength, and hope, right, what it was like. So, as I said, I grew up in New York City, and as I think back on my story now,
what really strikes me more than like the whole drinking portion is who I was, what I felt like before I picked up that first drink. Because as a child, there are two words. I was so lonely. Like, you know that book, The Little Prince, and he lives on his own little planet? Like, I felt like when I saw that, like, I was like, oh, yeah, I relate to The Little Prince. And I was so uncomfortable. And, and I grew up right in this neighborhood, and just alone. And I would watch people. I felt like I was, like, misplaced, like I got dropped off here. And when I, like, learned about alien life later on and saw E.T., like, I really related. And I really thought, and I mean, this is dead serious. Like, I thought that maybe, like, my true family would come and get me and beam me up, you know? And then that went on, like, the fantasies of just getting out of here, like, Narnia, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. I mean, that was a key book. And I read that book, and I knocked around my apartment in all the closets, all the walls. I was just like, let's go to Narnia, we're getting out of here. And it doesn't matter, you know, I used to talk a lot about the chaos and trauma in my childhood, but it's like, I've heard so many stories. I have sponsees with like perfect, beautiful childhoods, and then there's childhoods, mine wasn't like so like terrible, but it wasn't fantastic either. But that doesn't make me an alcoholic at all. Because that loneliness, that uncomfortability in my own skin, that was there long before I knew what was going on in my household. And I went to church every Sunday, but again, due to what was going on in my household, which was alcoholism, active alcoholism and denial and chaos. So there was no God, because what I was doing at church on Sundays, and then it wasn't translating to my home environment. So then I started drinking at age 11, and I was, this is 1980s New York City, so I was cold 45s, and they got you drunk faster, I learned. So my Bartle and James wine coolers, they took longer. And I was in Central Park drinking and vomiting, blacking out. Like, I drank alcoholically from the beginning. And I was thinking recently of this story, because these kind of drinking stories come and go now. And I don't really ever think of that part of my life anymore, because my life today, because of AA, is so fantastic. But this illustrates my drinking. Age 15 or 16, I was up in Maine where my family spent the summer, and I was at a party, and there was like my friend's older brother came, gave us a bottle of vodka, and I drank most of the bottle, like at least like 3/4, like I just pounded like water, and I was sort of trying to be cool, and I sort of also loved the feeling. My feeling, like, when I first started drinking was just relief. It was that mothership beaming me home, right? And I felt like part of this world. So I just loved drinking from the beginning. It was my solution to all my loneliness and uncomfortability. So whenever there was alcohol around, I drank as much as I could. Total inebriation, that was always where I wanted to go. There was no other destination for me ever in my story. So I was drinking the vodka. All I remember is I laid down on the sofa and I passed out. And then the rest was told to me later. I started vomiting uncontrollably as I was passed out. The older kids carried me, they got nervous, and they put me in a bathtub, and they put me on my side so I wouldn't choke on my vomit, which is great, someone thought of that. And then they ran cold water later and gave me a cold bath, so I was naked in front of all these people. And then they had to ultimately call their parents, get their parents to bring me home to my parents. So I was brought home. My parents, and I was carried in a bathrobe, in the mother's bathrobe, naked underneath, with throw up in my hair, my head put back, and handed to my parents. And I woke up, and I didn't know where I was, and I knocked the lamp over, and the light in my corner went on, and it was my mother sitting in the chair in the corner of my room. And it's funny because there's a lot of other things with my mother that aren't like that, but that's love, you know? That's love. We don't always get love the way we want it, but that's love. So she sat there all night listening to me breathing because she was worried that I could have gone into like alcoholic poisoning. So that's what my drinking. So then what happened is I wrote apology notes to everybody. I was grounded for 2 weeks, and then I was back at it. And not a thought. And I went to like some famous New York City alcohol counselor, doctor too. And I just nodded and smiled. Like I was never going to give this up. This I was in love with alcohol. And so what it looked like from that story until age 29 when I came into this program is, so then what happened next is 17, my brilliant, charismatic, generous, tortured, alcoholic, rageful father, he shot himself. So, and then when that happened, first it was like, ding dong, the witch is dead, because I was scared of my father. And I thought, you know, he was the problem. I was told that he was the problem of our life. And, but then I went really into shame. My mother was so ashamed because now our secrets were like sky high. Everybody on the other side knew thing. And, but then something good resulted from it. That after that, I realized I could drink however I wanted. Because now if you read my story, and you know, my heroes when I was younger were like Jim Morrison and Sylvia Plath. These are the people that I was like just enamored with. So after this, I really used this suicide as like my own like drama. I was always the heroine in my story, like a dramatic tale. And but now it's tragic, and you like stay away. And my uniqueness, like it was just sealed. So that's what happened, and then I went to college for a year, and then I left college. I didn't even go to class at college. It was incredible. As I went to college, left college, and then I came back and I got a job in fashion, which I stayed in fashion for another 12, 13 years. And my job, it never really mattered. I liked working, so I liked getting my own money, so I didn't deal with my mother, and nobody could come to work. And my drinking wasn't as messy as it used to be. I learned other ways. You know, there are other substances involved, which I won't go into, but I learned how to manage it more, so I wasn't blacked out and vomiting all over the place. But I was still drinking heavily. And work was never my goal. Work was just like, I need the money. But I was a real half measures kind of gal in any workplace. And I just did the bare minimum to get by. I flirted to get, you know, by bosses, whatever it took, right? So that was going on. And my main focus at that time was a man. I really was looking for a man. And then I was like very focused on this because for me, it was like every guy I dated became my higher power. And I really believed at that point, I wouldn't have even described my father as an alcoholic or called myself an alcoholic. And I really believed that there could be something external that could still help me. And I thought that the guy, right, he would be the savior. And he would move me to a suburb, we'd go live a ride, we'd get a dog, and we'd go to like barbecue night at the club or something, and like I'd drink normally, and I'd feel full inside. You know, I'd finally feel full. You know, when I read in the book, No Human Power, right? No human power could ever make me feel loved, you know? No human power could leave my alcoholism or fill this like hole, this loneliness inside. Only God can do that, which I learned later in this program. So, yeah, the man thing was a disaster, and it got bad. And as we know, but, you know, in the beginning, I got some all right guys, and as it went, you know, as my alcoholism progressed, I really found out with really big losers. And so, what happened is, it got to the point where it got uglier and uglier. As we know, it's a progressive disease. And consequences really started showing up, and I couldn't hide it anymore. And I was bruised all the time. I fell a lot. So I had bruises all over my body, and I would tell people about my vitamin deficiencies. And I was checking into emergency rooms often for my panic disorder. So I was doing that. Jobs were like losing and getting jobs were closer together. And so I could barely, and I really couldn't, I wasn't even dateable anymore. I mean, my violent outbursts were coming, like, I was so brutal. I would, like, one more attack. I punched him in the face. He was talking to a woman. I thought he was flirting with her, and I walked up and punched him. I would rage at the taxi driver. Like, there was one night where I raged so much, screaming at this taxi driver, like crazy. I mean, I'm lucky somebody bought a gun and just shoot me. Because that's what kind of drunk I was. And I didn't realize that I hated myself so much that that's why I was treating the world like that. I didn't know that then. So it got darker and darker, and I looked horrible. Like, I just was, like, overweight, really bloated, the bruises, I chain smoked, so I had these, like, sticky yellow fingers. No, they were from the tar. Like, my fingers were always yellow. And I used to pick my nails and bite them until they bled, so it was like bloody yellow hands. And so that's what it was. This is who I was. And back then. So I came to AA when I was 27 for the first time. And I was just getting so much heat from people. And I came in. And I really used AA like a diet plan. I'd already been to Weight Watchers before that. So I was like, okay, great. These people don't drink. A lot of calories in drinking. And I came in, and I sat there, and I, like, smiled at some of you. Mostly not. But I hated AA. But I was like, I'm just going to hide out here, lose some weight, get the right man, get a better job, and then I'm going to, like, reemerge in the world. But I knew that I wasn't like you. And I heard people qualify, and, like, one woman, I used to go to Lennox Hill Group, and she said she had, like, wine in her closet, and she was poking her kids, and she was pounding it and running to the closet, and I'm like, wow, these people, really, they are really big problems. So I left. And then the next year and a half before I came back, I finally got so dark. They say a head full of A ruins your drinking. And I wasn't even really listening to any of you. But some stuff, I just knew then that I had a problem. Something was wrong. So then I started trying to control it, and I did, like, the binge drinking thing, where I would wait all week. Like, and I knew that I couldn't have that first drink. I knew that there was a chain reaction that would be set off from the first drink. I didn't have the language yet, but I knew. So I just couldn't pass go. Like, I had to go right to my apartment, or leave work, run to my apartment, unless it was my one allotted night where I could be out. And by then, my bottom looked like, so I was living in this really gross apartment. I was basically squatting in this empty townhouse that a friend owned. It was in this, like, parlor floor apartment that stared into a wall. And you'd walk in, there was barely any furniture, and I just had this ashtray by my bed. And I had, and there was smoke, like, all over the apartment. So, he was just thick with smoke. It was disgusting. And the TV was blasting. Like, the real world was all going on. I thought these people were my friends. And I would lie in bed. I'd go on my one bender, and then I would lie in bed all weekend. So that's what it looked like. And finally, I just decided that I was going to kill myself. And I felt, like, so much pain inside, so isolated. That little girl, like, that lonely little girl. And so that was my plan. And then, what happened is I was in a nightclub, and I was in blackout. And then all of a sudden, like, I didn't remember. And then all of a sudden, I felt clear as day. I was sitting in this back booth at this place, Bungalow 8. And I felt clear as day all of a sudden. And I was sitting with, a bunch of leaders. It was like 3 in the morning. It was about to close. We were trying to figure out the next plan. And all of a sudden I heard a voice in my head, and it said, this is not the life intended for you. And I've heard voices like that in sobriety, and I didn't know what it was, and I totally freaked out. And I didn't get sober the next day, but I got walked up, walked out of the nightclub, and I went home. And then I think this is what happens in my experience, is that like when we, you know, we can call down grace, and we don't even know, like, we're praying, but I was crying for help inside, again, the heart, right? And then amazing things started happening. Like, things came together. Angels placed themselves in my life, and then 3 months later, I got back into these rooms. And I hated it here. Hated it. And I sat back with my arms folded, but I felt something that was, I felt hope. I felt safe, and I didn't want to talk to anybody. People that would come up to me, try to give me their number, I did not want to speak to anybody. But I heard one thing in the beginning. I heard someone share, and they said that you don't have to do anything, you just have to not drink and go to meetings, and the program will get you. Just keep coming back. So that's what I heard, and so I kept coming back. And you know, it says in the literature, and I've experienced this, that like just that crack in the door, it's amazing. Once you like have that slight willingness, it always expands. And then I got a sponsor, finally, and I worked my steps, and I did service, and I started working with others, and I had a spiritual awakening. So I want to talk about going to meetings, because I think something happens, as I said in the beginning, about the heart. And I was thinking about all these moments of transformation, because I could say it's all in the steps, and a lot of it is, because I started getting on my knees, praying, I started believing a higher power. My first higher power was nature. But then there are these like subtle moments of transformation that have happened to me, and they keep happening to me all the time, which is why like getting to meetings, it's not just about just do it for discipline-wise. There's like another reason. And maybe a year and a half, 2 years in, I went to a meeting on 64th and Park, and I was still really tormented over my father going to like a psychiatrist, and but I was still in a lot of pain around that. And I heard, I walked in and I saw this old man who was about to speak, this older guy, and I was like, oh God, I was still in the compare and despair game, like I would have nothing in common, but I got to tell my sponsor I went to a meeting, and I heard him speak, and I was sort of spacing out and like looking around and kind of stained glass windows. And then all of a sudden, he started talking about his suicide attempt. And he talked about how he had 3 kids, and they were going out with his wife, and he was going to poison himself with carbon monoxide. And he said, he talked about how much he loved them. Just how far away he felt, and how that was just the last thing he had to give them. That was all he could give them, and he knew that would be a gift, taking himself out of the picture. And I heard him talking, and it wasn't even the words, although I do remember them. It was just like all of a sudden, I just knew my father loved me. And I knew that he was sick, and he was suffering, and he was just one of us. And there was nothing unique about my story. And and it was just, again, we sit here, you hear that one thing, and I was just transformed forever, and it was gone. Everything else fell away, right? And it's incredible. That happens to me all the time. It's like I just hear something, and then I just take off a layer. So that happened. And changed my life. And then I met my husband in the rooms. And I like talking about this. I'm not sure how much time I have, but so I'll speed up. So I met my husband in the rooms, and so I had all these amazing things happen. I started feeling comfortable with my skin, and I met my husband, and then I was gonna be, I really, at some point, I forgot what I was doing here. And I was like, thank you so much. Now I've got this really big Santa scroll of passion prizes I have to go get. And my husband was like the beginning of that. So I got all these gifts, and I got married, Jack, had a girl, had a boy, got a nice apartment, got a closet full of Barney's clothes, then I was at home, I was, like, raising my kids, I was getting massages every week, I mean, you know, like, I thought, like, this is what it is, right, I'm getting sober, so I can do this, and I was, and I could tell you all about sobriety, and I still went to meetings, I never drank, and I still went to meetings, because I was a good meeting maker from the beginning, I had smart feet, but I lost what this was about. And I really thought it was out there. So and I hit a bottom with that. I got everything I wanted. It was so great. God gave me everything I wanted. And then I had to come back and do a lot more work. So I hit a bottom. But I wasn't ready to, like, fully engage with AA. I had some, like, loosey-goosey sponsors throughout the years. And I would, like, dabble, do some step work. But, so it wasn't, like, nothing, but it wasn't AA, as I do it now. And so I came, I started outside work, and I was, like, Landmark, Tony Robbins, TM training, but that wasn't to improve my conscious contact, that was just for my stress levels. And so I did all this stuff, and the crazy part is that for 5 years, and I came to, like, one or two meetings a week, but I was really busy in that world. It all led me back here. And then I really came back here around 2.5-3 years ago. And it's incredible. I just surrendered on, like, a whole different level. And I got a new sponsor a year ago and started working with a sponsor like I did in the beginning. And went through the steps again. And then when I looked at 6 and 7. I never really understood 6 or 7. Like, I was like, what is this? I got a lot of some of this stuff. How am I going to live in the world? But then I said, entirely ready. And I was like, yeah, I'm entirely ready. Finally, entirely ready. And I just feel like it's such a gift. And then all of a sudden, all these women, you know, which I was hoping for a book deal, but then I just kept getting more sponsees. Which my sponsor said was God's will. And God's will is not always aligned with mine, but it's always better than mine, so much better. And so I started working with others, and working with others, sponsorship is such an important part of this program, and working with others through 10, 11, and 12, right? Because if I'm not completely surrendered and doing, like, looking at my part, and if I'm trying to, like, help others through my ego or through my wisdom, you know, it's not the same as when I'm going to God. And I'm trying to really, and I still, like, now I get on my knees in the morning, and I pray, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart. Like, God, take all of me. Take all of me, and I mean it more than ever. And, like, another gift of sobriety recently is, so I have a 12-year-old daughter now, and a few weeks ago, I shared with her, she keeps asking me how, I didn't want to tell her how my father died, because when she was younger, and then I consulted someone outside and had to talk to her about it. And she kept asking me, so I knew I had to answer. I never wanted to lie about it. I don't believe that. We live in the truth here, right? It's about honesty. And so we have to be honest with ourselves and others. And so I consulted. They said, fine, tell her. It's the time. If she asks again, do not push it off anymore. So I had this conversation with my 12-year-old daughter, and it was so incredible. And she just asked. And she said, how did your dad die? And I said, suicide. She's like, oh, how? and I was like, how? And then I realized it was the way I was saying it, and the way I was talking about it. And we had this really beautiful, really calm, really healed, really like, I tied it in. She knows that I'm a recovering alcoholic. And so we tied it into that and part of the disease and how much it taught me, how lucky I am that this is my story. And and it was incredible. And so, and I felt like the circle closed, you know? The trauma wouldn't be passed on to her. So the gifts are big and small, and I think I have. Okay. So I hope I said something that helps somebody. Thank you.